Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to Midpoint. My guest today was a regular on our screens on major BBC news programmes, regularly in our living rooms telling us the big stories of the day and working on huge state events, interviewing royals and major global celebrities and figures alike. And we got to see the lighter side of her when she appeared on Strictly Come Dancing. Then, after she'd had her two children in her 40s, she decided she wanted to retrain to become a psychologist, specialising in children. She'd actually done her degree in psychology at Durham University, but of course to become a professional psychologist involved a lot more than that. She's done what many of us are not quite brave enough to do, and to do that really big career change in midlife. She's given telly the elbow as her career. I'm sure we'll see her back on it because she will be brilliant at explaining what she's learning in documentaries. But for now, she's focusing on those people she's helping, those children that she is treating. She is passionate about what she does. And as you'll hear, she has no regrets. Kate Silverton, it is so lovely to have you on The Midpoint. How are you?
I'm really well, and it's lovely to be here. Lovely to see you as well.
Yeah, and you are, for me, the kind of dream guest in many ways for Midpoint, because when I started this whole thing 2.5 years ago, I was really intrigued in people and guests who'd done something dramatically different in midlife, and whether that was leaving a relationship, starting a new career, doing something completely out of their comfort zone. And you have gone from the very established and in many ways safe kind of place of a brilliant broadcasting career to becoming a therapist. So tell us all about that dramatic change, because it sounds probably more dramatic than it is. I mean, does it feel like a natural organic process to you?
Well, do you know, it's really interesting just even hearing you say it, because it's actually been really recent that I've actually qualified. So it's lovely to hear you say it, because I feel like I've only just come up for air after what's been quite a long few years to qualify. So, yeah, where to begin? For me, safety has never been an option. And I'm sure we're going to discuss that, because I've always taken leaps. I think that came from my dad. So we'll hold him in mind, because he's been a great influence. But in terms of the child therapy, my academic background was always in child psychology. And I'd always worked as a volunteer with a lot of children's mental health charities, Place to Be, the Anna Freud Centre, the NSPCC. And I actually did Strictly with the intention of raising awareness around children's mental health. So it's been bubbling away, but that qualification, the actual change of career, and it is a change of career because I've stepped away from news and I'm now working in a primary school as a volunteer at the moment, as a therapist. I'm working clinically with the young children in my care. So that part really is. And that is quite a big move. So, yeah, it's really nice hearing you say it, because it's this probably for the first time really acknowledging that shift has taken place.
Yeah, because you did study psychology at Durham University, didn't you? Mm-hmm. So that's obviously, it's always been of interest in your mind. And in terms of children's mental health, what was the moment where you thought, this is so important to me and I'm so passionate about it that I don't want to just talk about it and be an advocate for charities? I want to actually get my sleeves rolled up and get involved in this.
I've always been the type of person, as I'm sure you'll recognise, that when you do it, you want to get really in and do it on the ground. And I think becoming a mum was the point, and understanding from my own therapeutic journey as well, just how important it is and how beneficial it can be, and understanding, you know, when I was interviewing and I've been talking to neuroscientists and psychiatrists, just with this interest in how we operate, how our brains work, how it influences our behavior, and everything I was learning just made me think everyone needs to know this. So there was this combination of wanting to do that work clinically and to be qualified to speak as a child therapist, as well as to also write about it, to share that wisdom and everything that I'd learned with as many people as I could. So there's been this sort of two-pronged approach, but the actual working clinically, and it's just been so rewarding already that it is absolutely the right thing to have done. And I think it was, though, becoming a mum that probably tipped me over into wanting to do it sort of more.
But becoming a mum is obviously the time when a lot of people then put things on the back burner in terms of changing big things in their life, because it's very hard to juggle being a mum, training, doing, you know, still rocking up on a Saturday night and reading the news to us, you know, so doing Strictly Come Dancing. Tell us about that, because people listening who may have something in their minds or hearts that's a burning desire to do something, but know it's going to be a bit of a slog to get there. Tell us about the juggle of studying and how that worked with kids, small kids as well.
Yeah, there's the slog and then there's the juggle, isn't there? So the sort of, I always say hard work works. So if you want something and you are thinking about it, that's the mantra, hard work works. I get that from my dad. He was a London cabbie. He changed his career many times. He was a locksmith. He then trained as a hypnotherapist. So I've kind of got that influence from him. It's like, if you want something enough, you go and you work hard for it. So that's always the mantra, whatever age we are. When we're juggling, I think it's accepting our limitations. So my children are now 10 and 8, and I started taking a backseat on news. Not that people ever really knew it, because they kept saying, are you on breakfast? I was thinking, I haven't done that for a few years. But I started, when I had children, I started working more and more and more part-time. So I think sometimes it feels that because we're in the public eye, we're actually, it's like turning this oil tanker sometimes with a career, isn't it? And you've got to do it quite slowly. So I think it has taken me almost a decade to get to this point. So it hasn't happened overnight. And probably the last year has been most intense with the studying. My husband actually said to me, you feel like you're busier this year, because I was studying and it's quite an intense course and qualifying, than when I was in news. So the last year has been quite intense, but my children are now a little bit older, but I'm so mindful. And in fact, I've just put my second book on hold, because I thought, how deeply ironic if I'm not looking after my kids when I'm, you know, talking about parenting and looking after. So I think it's that, the hard work works bit. If you're going to go for something and change your life, then I passionately believe that you can go for things. You follow your heart, follow your passion, but you've got to work for it. But also be mindful that we can't, you know, everything comes with time, but it comes at the right time. And sometimes we can be a little bit impatient with it. And I've had to really learn that. And just with this particular journey, I have let it come as slowly as I could possibly manage, because I didn't want to burn out.
You've clearly also, you mentioned your husband there, it's got to be a kind of family decision, hasn't it, when somebody does something like this? You can't be fighting against somebody else wanting you to, you know, not make those changes. So he was obviously was he very supportive?
Yeah, very much so. Our marriage has been this lovely sort of ebb and flow. When we first got together, I was like the main breadwinner, and then he set up his company and is now the main breadwinner. So he was the one that said to me, look, actually go follow this passion, do it now, you know, while you can. So we're very much a team, very much a sort of a team effort, and it has been like that. You make it work. I think there's that lovely poem, which is obviously normally attributed to Goethe, but I think it's William Murray, the mountaineer, and he talks about when you commit, providence follows you. And again, you know, with the theme of your podcast, I really believe in that. It's like, if you're up on a mountain face and you're sort of really tentative about something, you're more likely to fall than if you just go for it and commit. Providence there's a net that seems to come in and catch us. So we make these decisions, my husband and I, in our lives, you know, it's with thought and care, but actually at some point you've just got to go for it.
Also, because when you start to go for it and you commit, you'll find things. It seems like coincidence, but it never is, I don't think, that the energy that you then attract things that kind of make that work for you. So I think whatever it is that you're wanting to go for. And tell me about the satisfaction of, you know, you must have had moments, you know, whether it's recent or early on, where something happened, whether it's the children you're working with, where you need to be convinced that you're doing the right thing as well, don't you? You need a moment where you think this is absolutely the right decision.
I think I've never had a doubt, actually, just even from the first day on the course and in the therapy room. Obviously, I won't break confidences, but in the therapy room, it's like a magic that happens. And to see the healing, the repair, the change, and to have the feedback from parents, from teachers, from the child themselves, you know, just as I say, I had to be really careful not to break, but just, yes, it works. And it's a very, very special experience. And I feel really privileged to be doing it. I also feel that I'm in and where I'm meant to be. I really feel like I'm in my place.
And you've arrived at that place now where in society, we're just facing a kind of tidal wave, aren't we, of problems and issues with children obviously coming through the pandemic, but also the kinds of childhoods that kids are having now compared to 20, 30 years ago, the things they've got to navigate, whether it's online, social media, you know, kind of just having a digital device with them all the time, all those things, which I think, you know, generations to come will look back and it'll be like smoking almost. We'll turn around and say, I can't believe we let kids have those things with them. But, you know, I know it's tough and I'm not being lectury, but it just feels like we are heading to a place in the future where people will look back and think we're a bit crazy having these kind of worlds for our kids. So you are immersed in that now. And it's, you know, I imagine if you'd done this straight from university, you'd be a very different child therapist. We'd be dealing with very different issues to then.
Absolutely. I think having my children at the age that they are, I'm able to use that experience. And as you say, we all know how hard it is. I think a lot of how we used to parent in it was much more community-based. You know, our ancestors, we would have had a child, would have had on average, well, at least four or five other adults and older teens around, so that parents were always supported. In fact, the ratio was, you know, some would say it's 1 to 19. Whereas now when we think about it, you've got one parent generally, you know, a lot of the time, and a number of children. So I think there's this element of remembering that we're not meant to do this alone, parenting. It's so much harder now. We kind of think that just because we live in this modern world that's supposedly a lot easier with technology. Actually, I think quite the reverse. It's made us a lot more isolated. And it's very easy to use digital, you know, to use screens, because very often parents themselves need a break. So I would love it if we can turn it back a little bit and start saying, well, let's support each other. And instead of using screen, we use each other to say, actually, I just need a bit of time out. There's a lot of change that can take place. Actually, for children, the biggest benefit right now, having been through what we've been through, is the gift of our presence. And I sort of say, don't give presents as in, you know, boxed, wrapped present. Give your presence. And again, we can say, well, that's a bit difficult, but we have to make time for our children. That's the biggest thing we can do for them. When I'm sat there with a child in the therapy room, we have an hour together, 15 minutes together, one-on-one. And the benefits of just that one-on-one time, and I talk about this a lot with parents, even just 10 minutes a day, a 10-minute top-up with your children, whatever age they are, just to connect, look into each other's eyes, make each other laugh, give the, you know, that lovely oxytocin boost we get when we've made our kids laugh, whatever age they are. We all need that. And I think, you know, just to be aware of how our brains and how our children's brains are changing with the use of digital technology should start waking us up to thinking this is not how we're meant to be. It's just not.
What they're exposed to as well, that they can't handle, you know, that they're not able really to cope with as well, I think is quite frightening, isn't it? That, you know, the age that they're being exposed to things. And as an individual, that can be quite, you know, as a parent, it can be quite overwhelming to even think about that, can't it? Because you're getting pressured from, parents will be pressured from their kids about, you know, well, so-and-so's got this and I want that. And what do you say to parents who are feeling that they're succumbing to that pressure?
So, well, first of all, I think it's a big question, isn't it? Mm. I've just been on holiday with my sister and she's got six kids. And
wow.
Yeah, the twins in there and, you know, she was going for the girl. She's got five boys and a girl. And I was talking to them about this and I just said, look, when we understand, I think for teenagers especially, there's lots of really good documentaries out at the moment talking about how, you know, we all know that the algorithms are designed to keep us addicted and talking about dopamine rushes. And what I want teens to understand especially is that you're almost being played. So, you know, my husband talks to our kids and he's like, this will suck out your brain. You know, he sort of laughs and just says, you know, this sucks out your brain. And we laugh about it, but it's trying to sort of say to our children, it's not actually doing you any good. Let's think about it, because it's not their responsibility. It is our responsibility in terms of what we're giving our children access to. So we should be able to say no. I know that's hard. I know that's hard. I speak as a working parent and as children who's, oh, you know, my so-and-so's watching this. But, you know, on holiday, you know, I would get my children reading books. And if you can divert them into another means, and it does take work on our part, it does take investment, but we have to do it because it's too addictive. It's too easy. We can't really sort of expect our children to be the best masters of it, because even we're not, right? How hard is it for us to put the phone down sometimes? But I think if we come at it, and I always come at parenting from a perspective of science and brain development, because then a parent and we can all feel more empowered to think, right, what is this doing to my child's brain development if they're on a screen with this constant sort of reward that they get from the likes or the sort of what they're seeing? It's wiring their brain in a certain way. And when we start to see it that way, as you talked about with cigarettes or maybe whether it's alcohol, we might start questioning, well, okay, I know it's going to be tough, but I need to do it. And the more parents that we can do it and talk together, we have to do something, because it's not healthy for our children to be on screens all the time. And I'm not saying, all, you know, there's downtime, but it's particularly pernicious, I think, when you sort of got the addictive drive that comes from getting this dopamine hit. And there's a lot of research on it now, much more than there has been. So I think, look, my whole being is never, look, as a therapist, I'm always working with parents, and it's never about shame, blame, or, you know, I get it. I get how hard it is, especially if you're a single parent. I just need a break. But I think when we're aware, as we are now, of the potential changes that are taking place for our children's development, and as you say, what they're seeing, what they see cannot be unseen, and then it's fracturing our relationship. We're becoming more distant from our children. You know, if we all sat around a table rather than talking over dinner and everyone sat on a screen, you know, what is that setting us up for in the future? So it's a really big issue. And
it's not just kids though, is it? I mean, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day about restaurants that actually good restaurants, you know, decent restaurants that allow a whole table to sit on their phones in a meal. And if I was a restaurateur, it would be rule number one of my restaurant that you only get your phone out if, you know, somebody's calling you in an emergency. You're not sitting at the table scrolling at a table. It's just so it just makes me feel so sad, actually, because you kind of walk into a restaurant and think, you're not you're adults and you're not communicating. What chance have the kids got if you're the adults in their world, you know, to not be addicted to these devices?
Yeah. And also, what message does it give for us, as if we're talking about us as adults? You know, if I sat here with you now and I just kept picking my phone up, you know, what would you feel inside? You know, there's an element of
rejection.
Yeah, rejection, and like, how rude. But, you know, so when we're with our children, we're constantly picking up our phones and doing that. What message are we giving to them? So I do talk about that a lot, just for us to think, how might we feel if our partner constantly was picking up their phone and looking at it? That's the message that we're giving our children. I'd rather be on this device than sitting with you. Again, I'm mindful of saying this is not a sort of, you know, a cure-all, but I would love to start seeing some changes. And as you say, maybe restaurants can start doing phone bans and screen bans. Mm-hmm. They'd be forced to talk to each other and get back into that lovely rhythm, because we can all do it. But I think everyone's got so, it's almost like, oh, I don't know how to play with my child anymore.
I think the other thing as well that, you know, is important, it's like anything, isn't it? Foundations of a house, foundations of a relationship. If you go in early with these things, you are preventing potentially problems coming down the track that are going to be a lot more difficult to deal with. So the idea of saying no to a 10-year-old, you've got to try and think of this as a kind of a long-term game, haven't you? And your reward is coming later when you've got a great relationship with a teenager.
Absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely critical. And also, it's easier to then have that conversation with our 10-year-old if we've started at 5. Mm-hmm. And then at 10, we can say, do you remember how we spoke to you about, we can use age-appropriate language. But when we work with our children and they get that we're not just being mean by saying, no, you can't go on it, but there's a reason for it, then that's actually can be quite bonding. But then we have to follow up as well with, how about we play a game instead? So again, there's still the investment. We've still got to put that investment in, but it will pay dividends in the future with our teens and later teens.
One of the best books I read was called The Teenage Brain, and it's by an American psychologist. And it explained to me, I read it when my kids were 12, going on 13. It explained to me just how the teenage brain is wired differently to a younger brain and also an adult brain. It's going through this metamorphosis, and all those, and the thing that kind of really stuck with me was how teenagers just don't evaluate risk in the same way. And so obviously they feel they're going to get into trouble about something, so they don't tell you, and then it gets worse and all those things. And it really helped me understand what they were about. And I could see almost these examples, real life examples happening with my kids. And I'd tell them about this book, you know, and they were like, oh, mum's read a book. But I think, you know, the idea that we know everything as parents and we don't seek out help as well should also be kind of, you know, banished to some kind of, you know, shame cupboard. That the idea that you're just, you know, oh, I've got to read a book to understand my kids, so that's okay. It's okay to ask for help and understand a little bit better.
Well, you do your research when you go off and do your job, so, you know, why wouldn't we sort of research the most important job that we've got? And I think that's what I mean. I wrote There's No Such Thing as Naughty to explain how the brain develops. And funny enough, when it gets to teenager, it's almost that we go back, we see a lot more of that toddler behavior because all the sex hormones are coming in, and it almost, the what I call the wise owl, but the prefrontal cortex almost gets so overwhelmed, she goes back on her back going, I can't cope. And she's the sort of thinking rational one that sort of analyzes risk and everything, whereas actually she's so overwhelmed because of all the sex hormones coming in, she sort of almost goes to sleep. And then you get that. And also, our teens are meant to healthy risk take. That is what's going to propel them off into the world. That's what got us out of caves and going and exploring over the next hill. So it's about sort of encouraging healthy risk taking, competition with sport, you know, the good stuff, not necessarily the more negative aspects of risk taking.
By the way, when I said that's the best book, what I meant was it helped me at that point in my life. I have read better books, obviously. I'm not complete. Yeah, I'm not. I have.
I'm all for any book that talks about the brain and helps, you know, parents in terms of understanding, because I think we also want to feel empowered, don't we? We don't want to sort of feel that we're being, you know, finger wagged at. We want to kind of go, ah, I want to have the light bulb moment for myself. That's what I found when I was doing my training and all the people I was interviewing. And I was like, oh my God, everyone needs to know this, because it just makes behavior make sense and actually can take the pressure off of thinking, so my kid's not bad and I haven't done a bad job. It's just the development stage they're going through. And how can I help them in that regard, rather than seeing them as naughty or bad teens or terrible teens? Actually understand they're going through quite big processes, and then we can be kinder and more compassionate in that moment, as opposed to sort of retreating into that.
Yeah, locked horns. And, or, you know, often you see it, don't you, with dads and lads, it's that kind of silverback thing, in the kind of, you know, who's the biggest in the jungle, and you kind of, you know, have to just, no, it's okay, we've got room for two alphas here, it's absolutely fine.
Stay with me. We'll be back after this.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So you're going through all of this period of your life, a massive change, at the time when, as a woman, as women, we go through massive change. So tell me how that's been going for you.
Well, it's an interesting one. I'll share this for the first time, given that I know that the guests you've had on have also done the same. But it was interesting. So relatively recently, I'm not going to get too much information, but basically I sat in front of brilliant gynecologist Alan Farthing, whom people might know of, and I had to go and see him. And and so he was going through my history. And I don't know how many people know, but I have spoken about it before, but I really struggled to conceive. It took more than 5 years of trying, more than five IVFs before my husband and I eventually fell pregnant naturally at 41, having been told it was just literally not going to happen. And I'd sat with Alan, and so we were going through, and he won't mind me mentioning this, but we were going through the history, and, you know, I could see him, and he was sort of saying, so, you know, and I said, yes, I had these ovarian cysts and I had my ovary removed, and, you know, I had an AMH, my hormone level was very low. And I could see he was thinking, oh, you know, poor lady, you know, she's come to see me. And And then I said, and then at 41, I conceived naturally. And he sort of looked up. I said, and then again, I conceived naturally at 43. And he sort of just literally, and I was going to see him about HRT. So in my 40s, the point of this story is that I think we both sort of sat back and laughed, because in my 40s, I had not only produced two children, I'd conceived four times, had been pregnant four times in my 40s, sadly miscarried the two, but you know, and then was sat there saying to him, so tell me about HRT in the same decade. So there's sort of obviously sort of not, I'm not really an ideal way of doing things. I'm a big advocate for getting pregnant younger, I think, not that I had much choice in it, but you know, just in terms of, so I've got this weird thing going on where I've had HRT. I'd quite like to get off it, actually. I don't know what the thinking is on now, but I'm quite holistic in my approach to things. So I'm going to go and book in to see Alan again. So for the next one, to sort of say, do I need to be on it still?
What symptoms were you experiencing that you felt you needed it? What was going on?
Well, actually, I had to have it because I had my second ovary removed.
Right. So
I had 24 hours of actually being full on into there, because I did say to him, can I get away with it? And he went, no, trust me, you'll need a bit of help to get through that. So I didn't have much choice in it. So I had about 24 hours, I think, of experiencing what many people talk about, which was pretty far out in terms of a massive sort of feeling of change. And now, I don't know where I'm. I actually thought the other day I need to go and have a hormone check just to go and see how everything is. But
you're feeling good though.
And I'm really quite holistic, you know, in how I approach my health. So I very much take a temperature on how my body feels, how I feel, trying to sort of keep as much balance as I can. You know, we all know how important sleep is now. I mean, we probably get very boring in our old age, don't we? Because we've sort of had to learn the hard way of you know, I mean, I'm really a great one for pulling all nighters and, you know, pretty much a workaholic when I was younger. I haven't got the energy for that anymore. So,
but I think we have to cut ourselves a bit of slack on that as well, don't we? Because I think I don't really want to do it. An all-nighter, really. I quite like a late night every now and again, but only if I can have a lie in the next morning. But this seems like a really good time to bring in the expert today, Sarah Matthews, who is a consultant gynecologist, and we can put those questions that you just posed there to her, but there's also some other things I'd like to chat to her about today. So hi Sarah, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Gabby. Thank you so much for inviting me on this very interesting podcast.
Well, it's a perfect place to jump in because of what Kate just said there. Because I was going to start saying to her, oh, you can stay on HRT forever. And I thought, I'm not a gynecologist. I'll hand over to Sarah, who can tell Kate just that. If she wants to, I suppose, she could stay on it for a long time, couldn't she?
Well, it's a very individual thing. Some people like to take a holistic approach. And I'm very much in favour of a combined approach myself. But there's a lot that diet and lifestyle can do in terms of managing menopausal symptoms. And certainly, Kate, for you, yes, you went woof into the menopause immediately as soon as you came out of theatre. And Alan was quite right to put you on your HRT. I don't know how long you've been on it now, but obviously you didn't have a chance to go through any of the symptoms, and your HRT obviously worked very well at managing any possible symptoms that might have happened. So from my perspective, you see, I'm a Mrs. HRT forever person, because yes, I know that the studies are all out there and we can categorically say that there's nothing as effective for menopausal symptoms in the short term as HRT is. Longer term, there are probably some major benefits in terms of your cardiovascular health, in terms certainly of your bone health, and possibly for a decreased incidence of dementia and things like Parkinson's disease as well, osteoarthritis, diabetes, and certain forms of cancer. So if I put that on the table and say, right, okay, well, yes, you could stop your HRT. It's a very much your own choice, and could manage those potential risks of those diseases in many other ways, that I think as we grow and get more research going, now that the whole sort of WHI study conundrum has been lifted, I think it'll be unusual for women not to be on HRT in another 10 or 20 years. You see, I would see it as, I have a thyroid problem and I wouldn't not take my thyroxine. And we've got a bit of a design fault with our ovaries where they're stopping nowadays in about 2/3 of the way through your life. So you've got to live a third of your life without your hormones when every single tissue in your body has receptors for estrogen and progesterone. And we know that certainly cardiovascular disease, for example, is decreased very significantly in women who take HRT. And even that was the old style HRT, which was not as safe as the new formulations with natural progesterone that we have these days. And it's a case of, you know, from my perspective, it's a case of, right, if you're going to, we are going to live hopefully for a very long time. And the aim is to live older and be well as we get older. So the chronic conditions that cripple people in their 60s, 70s and 80s are diabetes, dementia, cardiovascular disease and fractures. And if we've got a very effective way to prevent those, then wow, would that not be a fantastic thing? So by all means, Kate, go back and see what Alan's take is on it. I do, you know, if people want to come off HRT, that's absolutely fine. Some people don't like taking medicines and you know, you can deal with things from a lifestyle perspective, from, you know, a vitamin perspective. You don't need HRT. Women will live without it, unlike my thyroxine or someone who needs insulin for their diabetes. But I think we will increasingly find that women live better on it than off it.
And the other end of the spectrum, I hope that was helpful, Kate.
Yes, no, I'm listening with intent. I tell you what made me think, because I watched Borgen. I don't know whether you saw that, but there was this comment about the lead character. She was having these sweats and everything. And it was her doctor that said to her, look, this is natural. Just you've got to get through it. And I thought, well, that's an interesting, you know, it was quite an interesting point to make, you know. So I'm going to sit with that. But I hear what you say. I think for me, I just don't want to, you know, have to keep remembering to put it on the whole time and have to keep going and get prescriptions and everything. So if I can find a way where I can work it through naturally, then that's always my first port of call. But certainly, as you say, if the balance tips the other way and it starts, you know, having a negative effect, then I don't have any objections to staying on it. I just object to keep going and having prescriptions and slathering it on my thigh every day.
Well, actually, that was kind of, I was going the other end of the spectrum, kind of early intervention with HRT is something I wanted to talk to you about today, Sarah, because I know there is a big school of thought, actually, that perimenopausal symptoms is the time really to kind of start intervening and not wait until things have kind of fallen off a cliff.
You have to consider, before I go into the pros and cons, I think we have to consider what's going on psychologically with people who start to develop sweats. It's just that, oh my goodness, this is me, this is it. It's the end of my fertility, it's the end of my sexuality. And it's partly the reason why I think women haven't come out as much, because they want to keep it to themselves. You know, today people, women are in denial, I think, or a lot of women would be in denial. And they're kind of hoping that it's just going to go away and disappear. But from an HRT perspective, we know that if you start your hormones at the right time. And for example, if I told you that you've got a substantially greater bone density loss in year one after your last period than you would have at any other time, and you can't make that bone loss back again, then if you'd started HRT around the time before your period actually stopped, that wouldn't happen. And that has a huge impact, a knock-on effect as you get older. Same thing with cardiovascular disease. We've got very good studies now that say that if you start it at the right time, don't wait, then you've got a much better effect of the HRT in reducing your cardiovascular disease. And the same, they think, might go for dementia. Now, the studies on dementia are a little bit mixed, but I'm going to refer to Davina's lovely program, where she had those two wonderful scientists in the States who were looking at brain changes in the first year after the menopause. And they very well demonstrated that you can't reverse that even if you start HRT once the change has happened. So I think timing is crucial. You know, we're really at the tip of an iceberg with HRT in the UK and in fact worldwide. And if, you know, men had the menopause, it would have been sorted out 40 years ago, that classic line. But I feel with time we will be able to identify, you know, I think, yes, when symptoms happen is a good trigger time. There's usually not much point in going on HRT before you have symptoms. But inevitably, people start to have symptoms, or the majority of people will start to have symptoms about 2 to 5 years before their last period. And for some women, that can be up to 10 years. And that's the trigger to go to the doctor for investigation.
And it's also, I think these conversations and Davina's documentary and talking more and more about it actually is where the list of symptoms is so much greater than just sweats. And I know the thing that triggered me to go and speak to you, Sarah, was this just a mood thing. And it was like feeling that I was increasingly ratty or, you know, not very joyous, didn't find the joy in life. And that was where I started thinking, oh, is this a symptom? You know, because at the time I just thought I was just being a bit moody and I didn't know why. And now I understand that was one of the symptoms because I didn't have those big dramatic night sweats or, you know, anything else that I'd seen kind of in the kind of classic sitcom kind of menopausal woman, which is what we kind of grew up with, didn't we? We didn't have any positive female menopausal women around. There was nobody talking about it. So do you think in a way that HRT needs a kind of reboot, a PR exercise, a kind of an HRT 2.1 or whatever it is to kind of deliver more of a positive story about the medical benefits?
Yes, yes, and super yes. But I think it needs to start with a little bit more investment by the health service in training their doctors. Unfortunately, the GPs in the UK have an option to learn about HRT, which is just ridiculous when you think that 50% of their patients are going to go through it and need, you know, they need to know about HRT. And there's been a lot of harm done because of the previous studies in the States. Of course, you know, whenever it comes to something that is, I suppose, optional, it has to be as safe as possible. And we're lacking the data still. And it's only good long-term studies that will show us that data. And I mean, Davina, you know, Mariella as well with me, you know, we did several, there's been some amazing TV programs. Meg Matthews as well has done, you know, and people like yourself, Gabby, who got out there, admitted it and gone through what's happening to you. And it's doing things like this that really will make a difference. And yes, we need to reboot. Women quite often know more about HRT going to the doctor than the doctor does, unfortunately. So I think it has to go back to training. It has to go back to educating women, educating kids, educating the boys, you know, and things that can happen around the menopause, and then work from there. But yes, it does need a reboot.
Well, Sarah, you are as I thought you would be a font of knowledge and a brilliant guest. Thank you so much. And I'm everybody listening, Sarah's disturbed her holiday to talk to us. I'm going to let you get back to the pool and the sunshine and your holiday. And thank you. Keep on doing the good stuff. Thank you. It is fascinating kind of how a narrative, I mean, from your news head, you know, your kind of journalistic head of kind of the years of working in television and news, you see how a kind of story can get misinterpreted or peddled out in a different way. And actually what's happening now does seem to be a retelling of the story of HRT and midlife and menopause.
Yeah. And isn't it wonderful? Well, I'm a huge believer in grassroots. And if we call, you know, if you, Davina, Meg, are the grassroots that can speak with a louder voice that gets heard, then I think all the more power for us doing it. And it does, it takes that sometimes, doesn't it? Just to sort of break through on particular, as you say, narratives. And to say you don't need to be suffering. And whatever the cause, you know, it might, whether it's HRT, whether it's, we shouldn't have to suffer in silence with anything. So reaching out, creating that sisterhood and brotherhood, but, you know, speaking about things, whether it's mental health, whether it's physiological, you know, whatever it might be, there's something hugely heartening about that. So thanks for doing what you're doing on that road.
Oh, well, not at all. Now, you're obviously in a fantastic place to talk about what you're doing as well, because you've got a great voice and you've got a platform. So, you know, talking about children's health, but are you missing, I mean, I'm sure you'll appear on lots of shows talking about that in the books you're writing, but are you missing anything about your old TV world?
No. It's funny, actually, we were flying back from Dubai and in front of us, there's a certain type of camera crew. You can sort of, all the guys are dressed and they're
the same in cargo pants.
Yeah. And all the big sort of pillar boxes and all the rest of it. And my husband works with his company, trains journalists. And there was a CNN journalist and, you know, he'd recognized her from one of the courses. And they had just come back from Afghanistan and we started talking. And my Mike looked at me and he just said, because I covered Afghanistan, I was in Iraq as well, and he looked at me and he just said, how do you feel, you know, just sort of seeing them coming back? And I said, oh, I couldn't, I just, you know, it just, it feels, I think there's, I don't know whether it's the timing, and we all feel it, you know, later, that there's a certain time for things. And I've always followed my heart, and I found joy in so much of television. I've loved my career. I've done so many different things and been really fulfilled. But this is the right time. I think what would be for me, and I'm not ready yet because I'm so immersed in my clinical work now and my family. I actually told my agent recently I'm off work for the foreseeable because of that. I just wanted to find that balance and to focus on my clients. But at some point next year, I would love to do, you know, to combine the two, because you can have the journalism, the broadcasting, to talk more about children's mental health and empowering and
because. Well, I'm sure you would front a brilliant documentary on the topic as well, because I think that's a way of really kind of something that can sit, whether it's on an iPlayer or whatever, can sit for a long time and people can go back to as a source of knowledge and as an educational piece, really.
Yeah, so that would be a lovely sort of, you know, full, you know, sort of full circle, as it were. But for the time being, no, I can honestly, hand on heart, I'm where I'm meant to be. I'm loving it. And just seeing the work firsthand and what it can do. So it feels right, very right.
Your happiness and joy coming through the screen at me there it seems like a really lovely place to end the conversation, because you have obviously made a very good choice and you'll be very inspiring, I'm sure, to a lot of people listening who are thinking of making those choices as well, Kate. So thank you so much for your time and also for what you're doing. I'm sure you're going to write brilliantly on the topic as well.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you. Really good to see you.
Thank you so much to Kate Silverton, who I think you'll agree is a very inspiring woman. And maybe you're listening to that and you're thinking, I really want to do it. I want to go for it. So hopefully she might have given you that little kick that you need to do something a bit different in midlife. And thank you to Dr. Sarah Matthews as well, who is a quite brilliant woman. She's certainly taught me a lot about my body in the last few years. And I think she is one of a growing force of really brilliant, bright, intelligent doctors, physicians, and learned people who are pushing the menopause up the agenda and helping to create change in that area as well. And thank you to Rethink Audio for producing, and to you for listening, of course. I'll see you next time. Have a great week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.